And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Eric Christian. He's a senior research scientist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He's the deputy principal investigator for the instrumentation package that will be on the Parker spacecraft that will launch in just a few weeks. The Parker Solar Probe mission will fly closer to the sun than any human-made object has ever gone. A mission 60 years in the making, Parker Solar Probe, a probe makes a historic journey to the sun's corona, a region of the solar atmosphere. With the help of its revolutionary heat shield, the spacecraft's orbit will carry it to within 4 million miles of the sun's fiercely hot surface, where it will collect unprecedented data about the inner workings of the corona. Dr. Christian, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And for this morning's conversation, I thought we would break Parker down into three pieces. One, the journey from Earth to our sun's orbit. Second, the instrumentation package and what we hope to learn. And then finally, the technology that is deployed to keep Parker from incinerating as it collects data at 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. So let's start with the journey from Earth to our sun's orbit. It's a fascinating journey, isn't it?
Yes, so we use Venus, actually. We end up losing some of our energy by swinging by Venus. And over the 7 years of the mission, we're going to do that seven different times. But even on the first orbit, the way we get in close to the sun is we'll swing by Venus and get closer the first orbit than any other spacecraft has ever gotten.
Wow. So is this... do we do this because we're trying to get in position for the orbit, or do we do this because we're trying to build speed with these seven slingshots?
So we're actually trying to lose speed. The Earth in its orbit around the sun is already moving at a very high speed, something like more than 20 miles per second. So we need to lose that speed, actually, to fall in close to the sun. But these gravity assists help us save a lot of fuel. We would need a much bigger spacecraft with much more fuel if we didn't use the gravity assist from Venus.
Oh.
Dr. Christian, it seems as though 4 million miles to you, that sounds pretty close, but to the rest of us, 4 million miles from the sun's surface doesn't sound like very close. How close have we been prior to that?
So if you think of the distance from the sun to the Earth is a football field, and so the Earth is at the 100 yards away from where the sun is. The closest we've ever been to is about the 25th yard line, and Mercury is more like the 30th to 35th yard line. We're going to get to within the 4 yard line, so we're going to be well in the red zone for the first time.
The red zone, the hot zone. So let's talk a little bit about the materials in this shield. It's going to be carbon on carbon. And I know that obviously this is about the most heat resistance kind of material that's out there. And I know that, you know, it'll withstand 2,500 degrees. What are the, how did you choose those materials? And I was reading about hafnium and tungsten and other heat-resistant materials. How did you come to this configuration?
So things like tungsten are heat-resistant in that they don't melt, but they also transmit heat. We needed something that not only could survive the high heat, but would act as an insulator and shield us from that high heat. And in order to do that, we have this 4-inch thick, mostly carbon foam, very low-density foam, but it's got carbon-carbon face sheets. There are thick sheets on either side that give us structural support, and that's how the rest of the spacecraft is attached to the foam of the thermal protection system.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating mission to be able to get out to the sun, to be able to keep our instrumentation package from incinerating at 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, where the last orbit will be around the sun when we're about 3.8 million miles from the sun. What will the temperature of the spacecraft and the instrumentation package be if it is protected as well as we think it will be with the carbon foam?
Well, so I like to joke that my instruments hide in the shadows, and So the back end of the spacecraft, where all the important electronics are, is basically at room temperature, 70 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
What was the temperature again?
So 70 to 75, room temperature.
Oh, great. Fahrenheit. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Can you tell us about the instrumentation package itself and what we hope to learn?
So we have a wide range of instruments, because for each energy of particle, you need a differently designed instrument. We measure everything from the solar wind energies, which are pieces of atoms that are moving at about 1,000,000 miles an hour, up through what are called solar energetic particles that are moving at half the speed of light. We also have some instruments that measure the electric and magnetic fields coming off the sun that are very important for understanding how the charged particles that are the solar wind and the solar energetic particles get accelerated. And we even have a pair of cameras that look off to the side of the sun to study the corona in just in white light, what your human eye sees. They can't look directly at the sun. They just burn out the cameras completely. But they can look off to the side and look at the structures, the same structures that you would see during a total solar eclipse.
I think last year with that total solar eclipse, that's when it really struck home for people the sun's power and what it does for us if you were in that total eclipse, the full eclipse, and it became cold immediately. It was a really bizarre feeling. You know, I'm just wondering up to this point that, you know, what is the information that we have about the sun? Everything revolves around it. And yet, again, we sort of take it for granted.
So the sun is a variable star, and its output is always changing by a small amount, essentially about every 11 years. But there are also longer-term trends, and they can affect us. In addition, the storms coming off the sun, what we call space weather, affect us more and more as we get more and more dependent on technology. And so understanding the sun, I mean, we like to joke that of all the stars in the sky, the sun is the one that's important. Without the sun, we couldn't have life on Earth, and we don't really understand it as well as we'd like to. So we can prepare ourselves for any changes, any storms coming off the sun. So that's one of the goals of this mission.
So being more dependent on technology, what are the effects that the solar flares and solar storms have had thus far?
So we know that the solar storms can affect spacecraft. A really bad storm could actually disable spacecraft. And really bad storms can actually affect us here on Earth because they actually cause extra current in the high power line that the electric companies use. And solar storms have been known to cause blackouts by actually getting the room-sized transformers they use to explode. That happened in Ontario in 1987. And so the power companies can handle it if they have warning that it's coming, but at the moment we don't understand the sun's variability to be able to predict space weather and warn the power companies very well. So that's what we're hoping to get to eventually.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Eric Christian, who's a senior research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's also the deputy principal investigator for the instrumentation package that'll be on the Parker spacecraft that will launch in a few weeks. Dr. Christian, we're actually in the atmosphere of the sun, aren't we?
Yes. So the sun's atmosphere actually extends all the way out beyond the orbit of Pluto. The solar wind at this million-mile-an-hour blowing wind that the sun gives out in all directions at all times extends out beyond the orbit of Pluto, and only the Voyager 1 spacecraft in the last couple years has gotten through that bubble that the sun has blown in interstellar space. So Voyager 1 is the only man-made object that's out in interstellar space. But that's more than 11 billion miles away from the sun. So this bubble that we call the heliosphere, this atmosphere of the sun, is really enormous.
Sure is. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we dodged a big bullet several years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, with a mass coronal ejection that was colossal that just missed the Earth. Is that true?
It's, That's right. So the biggest event that we've got any sort of records on actually happened in the mid-19th century, but it was big enough that it actually caused problems for telegraph lines, which at the time were the only long conductors on the planet. The one that we saw 4 or 5 years ago from the STEREO spacecraft, which is way off in a different orbit around the sun, may have been almost as big, but luckily was not pointed at the Earth, and so we did dodge a bullet.
If you look up coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, as you probably call them in the industry, you find, going back to 1989 in Montreal or somewhere in Quebec,
yep,
where there was a total blackout from a solar flare or from a coronal mass ejection. And that was a long time ago, but that's what sort of comes up in the search terms. Talk a little bit about that. You must know about that. And what are the major events that we've had really since then?
So the power companies have gotten able to handle it better. And we actually have a spacecraft, NASA has a spacecraft called ACE, that gives us almost a half an hour of warning for some of these big storms. So the combination of the power companies being more aware of it and some information, we haven't had that sort of big blackout since then, because there have certainly been coronal mass ejections as big as the one that caused the Ontario blackout. But these really big events happen, you know, on the order of once a year, depending upon the solar cycle.
Right. So after the Parker Solar Probe makes its mission and retrieves the data that it's hoping to get, will that predictability increase, you know, beyond, obviously that's what you're hoping for, but how much more lead time will you have in predicting these flares?
So it's a little difficult to say, because what Parker Solar Probe is doing the basic science that will help us improve predictability. Rather than being a space weather station the way ACE is, it's actually doing basic science. And if you think of terrestrial weather, it's sort of like understanding how the winds at different altitudes affect each other, and understanding the basic science that then allows you to do the models that do the terrestrial weather prediction better. So it'll take some time, especially since I'm quite convinced we're going to be surprised by what we see. Every time we've gone to someplace new in the solar system, we've been surprised. And we have predictions of what we're going to see close to the sun, but I'm willing to bet they're wrong.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because we do have expectations for what the instrumentation package will be able to deliver, maybe confirming some thoughts that we have about the sun. But there's always the thing that just grabs us out of nowhere it's a surprise. What sort of surprise could be out there?
So when we're trying to understand how the solar wind is accelerated, how these solar energetic particles accelerated, why the corona is hotter than the surface, the theories sort of fall into two broad groups. And one is that it's a continuous process that's always happening. What happens is electromagnetic waves, basically the particles surf on electromagnetic waves and get up to high energy. And the other is this thing called magnetic reconnection, where the magnetic field lines actually snap and reform. Those are the two groups of theories that try to answer these questions. They both might be wrong. That would be a real surprise. It may be something different entirely. I mean, it's hard to predict what you don't know,
yeah.
But I'm quite sure that we're going to be surprised by something.
Yeah, and the window of opportunity for this particular space shot is early August. Is it currently on schedule? I know a date has not been reset yet.
So we're, the current launch date is August 6th. We have we can launch at least until August 19th and probably until about August 22nd or 23rd. We have to catch Venus on the first orbit. And so if we slip past August 23rd, we'll have to wait another year or so before Venus is in the right spot for us to slingshot past it. So but everything, I mean, the spacecraft is fueled. They had a minor issue with one of the cables for the rocket that looks to be pretty well fixed. And so I'm still very much hoping that we launch in August.
That's pretty exciting. So I'm curious about testing the heat shield, the thermal shield. How do you go about testing something like that when it must be difficult to even get to those temperatures?
So, yes, they built a special set of heat lamps, a whole room of heat lamps, basically, to warm it up to 2,500 degrees. The heat shield, actually, they spent many years and a lot of effort to test it before we even started on the rest of the spacecraft, because without that, we didn't have a mission. And so, and that's one of the reasons why we're finally launching Solar Probe now. It was actually proposed back in the dawn of NASA as one of the things NASA should do, but the technology hasn't existed for us to do it. So it was, like I said, years of testing. They designed special ovens to get up to that temperature and supply all the heat the way the sun would. And they're pretty confident that, you know, all the testing shows that it'll survive without any problem. So.
Wow. So you've been working on this project for how long, the Parker Solar Probe?
I've been working on it for about 10 years.
Wow. And previous to this, so this is all part of NASA's Living with a Star program, which explores aspects of the relationship between the sun and the earth that affect us. What were the projects that you worked on prior to this, and how long have you been with the Living with a Star program?
So I haven't worked on the earlier Living with a Star programs except for STEREO. I've worked on a bunch of different spacecraft, actually, starting with the Advanced Composition Explorer, which has been up there for more than 20 years and is our prime space weather station. And I've worked on STEREO and some missions, like I worked on Voyager, our deep space probes. I study solar energetic particles, and I've worked on a whole bunch of spacecraft, but the ones that I've helped build are sort of ACE, STEREO, and now Parker Solar Probe.
It's hard to believe that anything could be more sophisticated than Hubble as far as a space telescope, but because it's provided so many spectacular images for all of us to look at. But the James Webb telescope is going to have even more capabilities with a very, very sensitive infrared instrumentation package to be able to gather light from very far away. Is James Webb using something similar that Parker is using as far as shielding the sun? Because I know that the sun needs to be shielded as well with James Webb.
So James Webb has, in some ways, an easier time of it because they're near Earth orbit, relatively speaking, and so only have to deal with one sun, whereas Parker Solar Probe has to deal with a sun that's 625 times brighter than it is at Earth. They use a bunch of very thin foils to protect, but they also need to get to a much colder temperature. In order to do infrared astronomy, the telescope is going to be much colder than room temperature. And so what they do is they use a bunch of expanding sheets that just act like foils. It's more like the you know, you can think of the aluminum foil that's part of your house insulation and stuff. But they use a series of those to protect themselves from the sun over a much wider area than the Parker Solar Probe needs to.
Goddard Space Flight Center is just such an interesting facility, and we've spoken to people about global precipitation measurement satellite. Does CAT scans of storms. We've talked to people at Goddard about the repair of satellites by autonomous devices, so that man is not involved. And we're certainly talking to you. And it must be incredible just to go to the cafeteria and sit there with all these different people working on all these interesting projects, not to mention the fossils, the dinosaur fossils that were found on your property. What's it like going to the cafeteria?
So it's, you know, you sort of get used to it. The time I was most amazed was when I first got here to Goddard, fresh out of getting my PhD, and I walked down the hallway I was working and realized I recognized the names of most of the people in the hallway because, you know, I had read their papers and they were, you know, the top people in the field, and it was just like, oh. But other than that, I mean, you know, Goddard's a great place to work. It's spread out among a bunch of buildings, but it's also got woods and deer and all sorts of wildlife and stuff. It's a very pretty campus, sort of. And you know, you hear things at the other tables, but it's you know, people like the main engineers for Hubble and stuff, you know, are not recognizable everyone by face, even by those of us in the field. But you do hear some interesting conversations at the tables nearby, and it is a great place to work.
So it's eavesdropping on the conversations that allows you to know who these scientists are that are speaking.
Scientists and engineers, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So speaking of that, well, first of all, your PhD was in what?
In astrophysics. Yeah, so, I worked on the Voyager deep space probes, actually, which have been up in space for more than 40 years, but that's what I did my thesis on.
Oh, wow. Now, how many young people do you have around Goddard, you know, who are maybe in the midst of getting their undergraduate, their graduate, or their PhD in terms of having an active internship programs and things like that?
So NASA has a very active intern program, and we love getting, you know, new people in here. It's always very exciting. My individual lab only has, you know, 6 or 7 full-time scientists, but we had 5 interns this summer. So it's an important thing. I mean, it's NASA education and public outreach has been very important for NASA and me through my entire career, because I work for NASA because of the Apollo landings when I was a kid, and inspiring the next generation for STEM education is really important. And internships is one of the ways you get the people to you know, realize, wow, this is a great place to work. And it is. It's a huge amount of fun. I wanted to work for NASA since I was 8 years old. And it's a different environment than most places, because the people who work for NASA want to work for NASA. You know, it's not just a job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I must ask you, of these young interns that are there at Goddard, about what percentage of them are young women?
So not high enough. Mm-hmm. It's getting better, but it's certainly... there's still plenty of room for improvement. We would love to see a full range, you know, the young interns matching the population of the country, and we're working on that, but it's not something you can just change overnight. We've got to change some attitudes at the younger, you know, ages, and I think it's really important that we continue to try to push for diversity.
Dr. Christian, you're a very curious person. What one question would you like to see answered that has not been answered yet? And you can pick any topic you want.
Oh, wow. I guess, you know, everyone wonders whether there's life, even just simple single-cell life, somewhere even in our solar system, but certainly, you know, somewhere else in the universe. That's one of those questions that you know, helps. If we can find it at other places in our solar system, you know, Europa or Io or something, then that means that at least simple life is common throughout the universe. And that would be, you know, world-changing. That would really... it means that many other places in the universe, there's at least some form of life. And if there's simple forms of life, there's the possibility of evolution to more complex forms. And that would be really exciting.
And with the new space telescopes, we're going to be able to look at some of the exoplanets and get a better feel for the vegetation, if they have vegetation. I mean, who knows what's out there, but it's going to be interesting.
It certainly is going to be. I mean, you know, all of us work for, you know, in astrophysics and astronomy and stuff, you know, want to travel to distant parts of the universe. You know, we may not be able to in our lifetime, but we're taking the first steps.
Yeah. Dr. Eric Christians, a senior research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's the deputy principal investigator for the instrumentation package that will fly on Parker as it heads towards the sun. We will all be keeping our eye on the launch, and of course, probably staying in touch with you a little bit. It's going to be 7 years until this thing gets to where it's getting to that right orbit. Is that correct?
That's correct. But 3 months after launch, mid-November, we're going to be closer than any other spacecraft has gotten, and that's going to be the start of the interesting stuff.
Yeah, and you will have done your shakedown of your packages by then. Is that correct?
Yep, it's going to be a little rushed, but yes, we will.
Well, listen, break a leg, and thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio, and best of luck with this program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.